Podcast has started. You know what it is. No intros needed. I'm going to start with what I think is the biggest hot button issue, the topic that some people might be watching this video for. Did Anthony Joshua save boxing by absolutely annihilating Francis Ngannou?
I don't know if he saved boxing, but he definitely confirmed something that we were all hoping that Tyson Fury would confirm, which is that you can't come over from another sport and jump to the top and have success, right? So the surprising part of the Fury fight was how well Ngannou did and sort of how uncommitted to the fight Fury looked. And this was sort of what we were expecting the first time around, and Joshua just delivered it in a very dominant and fundamentally sound way. And if he didn't say boxing, I think he certainly has put his career back into a place where we can legitimately talk about him as one of the best, if not the best guy at heavyweight. I don't think he's the best guy at heavyweight, but he'll get the opportunity to prove that, I think.
Well, I think that for Joshua, it's like, how frustrating is it that Alexander Usyk exists? It's like Usyk was his pathway to being the great heavyweight in the modern era. Usyk kind of schools him twice. It seems like unless Usyk gets old overnight, it's just a bad matchup for Joshua because he struggles with fluidity. He struggles with guys that transition offense to defense. Thing I felt going into this fight was, like you said, Joshua takes the sport very serious. That's something that's different between him and Fury. Also, the guys Joshua struggles with, Joe Parker, Usyk, etc. What do? They're fluid. Those are the guys that have always troubled even Andy Ruiz. They're fluid fighters. The guys that are very stiff and robotic, that is always going to be the guy that, you know, my man, Anthony Joshua, I feel like is going to look like a million trillion bucks. When you get a guy who's a bodybuilder or a stiff fighter who's just going to stand with you, that's when he looks like a generational great.
Right. Even with Vladimir Klitschko, as great as he was and being at the end of his career, he never had the most fluid offense or fluid style. And I think that, like you said, those are the fights and the times. Even, you know, someone like Jermaine Franklin, right, gave him a pretty tough fight. Jermaine's got a more fluid offense than your average heavyweight. So I think clearly those are the kinds of guys that give him problems, which is also why I think Fury would give him so much problems, right? Because Fury's offense at its best is extremely unpredictable and has a lot of variety to it, probably more variety than Joshua's.
Okay, Jesus M, we're not ignoring you. We're going to do a Canelo talk after probably the top two fights on this card, because top two fights deserve being talked about, and then we'll get there. My good friend, boxing writer Abe Gonzalez. I guess he's Abraham Gonzalez. I can't call him Abe. That's unprofessional. Lukey looking like new money with his supercuts haircut. I am. Which is the reason why the Wilder fight is still money. I think that the issue I have with Wilder versus Joshua at this point is Joshua seems like he really wants to be the best fighter in the world, the best heavyweight. Wilder just has a lot of strange stuff going around with him. There's now like a drama with his brother. There's a lot of like, he enjoys being a star, but in the wrong way. Kind of disappears after fights. I don't
see what is the brother issue.
So this brother released a diss song on the internet and said that Wilder was his biggest hater and released like voice memos that I ignored and didn't, but it's just this weird internal thing.
Familial beef.
It's a family beef, and I'm sure it's going to get worked out, or I hope it gets worked out, but it's just a weird thing that you don't really see Tyson Fury as brothers, and you don't see them doing that publicly for as weird as his saga is. And it just feels like Wilder's at a stage where he's really enjoying being a celebrity. He's talking freely about doing experimental drugs like he's Joe Rogan, but he's in the middle or at the end of a prize fighting career. To me, there's a lot of red flags on the motivation of Wilder in terms of how much he really wants to be a high-level athlete. Whereas with Joshua, I think there is a tentative nature to him when he fights a fluid fighter that limits him. But I truly think he wants to be the greatest heavyweight of the modern era. Like, I think he's willing to do those sacrifices. I just think that there's a limit to him. Whereas Wilder, there's a limit, but he hits hard. But I also think there's a motivation issue. So at this point, I think it's hard to not believe Joshua wouldn't just beat him, because you're seeing two different mentalities of fighters.
At the moment, I think Joshua would knock him out. And I think also to make the fight between Joshua and Wilder, you have to really overlook these last two performances by Joseph Parker. You got to really be going out of your way to not notice that this guy's doing some of the best work at
heavyweight. Don't bury the lead. We got to answer a few more questions on this. The business of boxing.
I'm just saying, I got to stand up for my guy.
No, but like, I agree. What did I tell you on the phone last night? I called you and I said, Joseph Parker might be well on his way to being boxer of the year in 2024. That's how I feel, because basically, like, his last win over Wilder was basically 2024. It was like 7 days before 2024. It was basically two wins this year. The issue is, people, like, this is what's messed up about boxing, right? We kind of see it in other sports, the NBA. I'm hearing all about Anthony Edwards, right? Anthony Edwards, he looks like Michael Jordan. He's really good. But if Jokic is really good and he wins titles and he's effective, you get fair and adequate coverage about Jokic. In boxing, this is a circus sport. So when Joe Parker does something and revives his career with a very good coach in Andy Lee, you never hear the story arc of, man, this Joe Parker guy can really fight. And we thought that he was done, but now he resurrected his career. And it's always like, who's the biggest names we can throw in together? Like, who are the biggest names, even if they're not really relevant or it doesn't make sense? We need to make the money. And I think that that's kind of like the issue with boxing as the whole, is we don't think about what's the most interesting fight. It's like, who has the most followers? How can we pit these guys together, even if one guy's at the end and one guy's in the beginning? This is epitomized by the possibility of Conor Benn fighting Manny Pacquiao, which to me is just two guys at different stages in their life.
Yeah, that's a fight that doesn't make any sense. And I totally agree with everything that you're saying. We're coming up against that time and time again right now, right? Is like that conflict of, are we making fights with the most notable fighters, and notability could be with or without boxing, or are we making the best fights available? And I think that's sort of the identity that boxing is having a hard time finding, because if it was just about that, I feel like Joseph Parker would have been the story of the night.
I agree. Also, Abe G says, in reality, Joshua fights Hrgović next for the IBF strap in the summer. I mean, that's a great fight to me. I think, given kind of the inconsistencies of Hrgović over the past few years, it's hard for me to believe he beats a fighter like Joshua, who, if anything, fighting in Saudi Arabia has kind of revived his career. Like, he was in a very weird place in British boxing history, and then he goes over there, annihilates Otto Wallin in a fight that I think we thought could have been a 50-50 fight. Then he humiliates Francis Ngannou and kind of treats him the way, as you said, treats him the way you expect a professional athlete who's spent his whole life boxing to do a guy who's an MMA fighter. You know, he showed him zero respect, highlight reeled him, humiliated him. And I mean, to me, I left this fight thinking Ngannou's probably going to fight Deontay Wilder at some point. Like, I know that's wrong, but that's like, I left this and I was like, who's the next big name guy? And I'm like, okay, Deontay. But I mean, Joshua went from me viewing him as a total head case, wondering what was going on, having honestly average performances against average fighters who felt like they were being brought in to build his confidence, to arguably being as confident as probably before the Ruiz fight, in this fight, and honestly in the Wallin fight. Before we wrap up, obviously Joshua is the most famous fighter we're going to talk about today, maybe outside of Canelo. Why don't you give some final thoughts? Because I think there's probably people that are working their local union shift or graveyard shift, and they want a little bit more Joshua talk.
My hope for Joshua is that we do get a rematch between him and Joseph Parker. I just think that that's a huge fight. It's not going to be the biggest fight in terms of sales and money that can be made at heavyweight, but I think it's the first fight was very close, and I think they've both really come into their own since the first time they fought, and they're sort of peaking at this point in their careers, and I think the significance of it and the level of it will be higher than the first one was. And I think the winner of that fight will truly deserve to fight the winner of Fury and Usyk.
To me, that first fight, and you know I've said this forever, Parker put a little doubt in Joshua's mainframe, because I saw that as like a 7-5 fight. I thought Joshua just barely won. And I thought the jab of Joseph Parker in that fight really troubled AJ. I don't think that he liked the fact that if he came in recklessly, Joe Parker stood his ground, popped a jab, had his right here, and then would pivot off in an angle. He provided himself as a moving target who was very comfortable standing in range to jab. And I think Joshua likes two things: guys that stand in front of you or guys that just move excessively. And Parker was the happy medium, like an Usyk in many ways, where he was willing to jab, but he was also not willing to excessively move, which is kind of the kryptonite of Joshua, when guys will stand in front of him, hit him, turn, and now Joshua's, because to me, the issue with Joshua, the reason why he's so stiff and doesn't punch in combination, is there's some technical flaws. He loads up on punches. He throws punches extremely hard for an extremely exciting finish, but he can overcommit to a shot, which can get him out of position where a guy like Usyk or a guy like Joe Parker can touch, turn, and now he has to reset, and they did a whole little, and he did a whole lot, and they came away with 3 points, and he came away with nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a lot of respect for Anthony Joshua as a fighter, man. It takes a lot to lose a couple and to get stopped and to lose to the same guy back-to-back. It takes a lot of heart and a lot of self-belief and a lot of digging deep to do what he's doing at this point in his career.
And I've been hard on him at points, basically because, like, so much money was behind him, right? Because it's like he literally had like probably the most money of any modern fighter almost outside of Canelo. So it was kind of hard to screw this up because there was a machine behind him. But this final chapter to me is showing that he really deserved that.
And look, Lennox Lewis got knocked out twice, right? Like it's corny, right? But it's not over till it's over. Like we watch careers in their entirety. And even in many of the greats' careers, right, there are moments of doubt. There are moments of questioning where they're at. Any great fighter has gone through that. Manny Pacquiao got knocked flat out on his face, you know, 15, 12 years ago, whatever, in front of millions of people, and came and had a whole other chapter of his career. So every legend has to overcome these questions.
I think another part of his story that I'd like to add to this is he's a British boxer who behaved like an American fighter in many ways, where he distanced himself from the media, whereas most British fighters built a great relationship with the British media, maybe not a great relationship with other media, but there was like a close-knit British community. He distanced himself. And I think that's also an interesting element to the Joshua story, is maybe some of the pushback too is that he wanted to be viewed as like a LeBron James. Who does LeBron James turn to if he wants to get a story out? Like, I don't think LeBron builds those relationships with media people. And I think Joshua was the first, probably of many new British fighters, that didn't build that relationship with the British media.
Do you think that affects him negatively now?
I think just the way his career finishes will define his legacy, because I think what he is doing, whether he wants to or not, is the narrative will be shaped on performance, not based on him. So I think like a guy like George Groves has achieved a lot less, but being who George Groves is and the great personality he is and what he's contributed to boxing after, especially in a British context, Groves is a beloved figure that I think many fight fans will go to bat for because of the personality. I think AJ is built like a Sugar Ray Leonard in terms of like he's a high profile, do no wrong guy. But he also wanted that exclusivity of a Floyd Mayweather.
Right. Well, and I think on some level he has achieved that successfully.
It's an interesting final chapter. Let's just hit on this Canelo Munguia real quick before we shift gears to the Joe Parker. It was announced last night. Canelo's fighting Munguia. It's May 4th. It's big fight, you know. Obviously, we're going to be talking about it quite a bit, especially as it gets closer, because people click on those type of videos. We're in the business of videos that get clicked on. Let's look at what Jesus M. asked. BT Canelo was insisting Jermell Charlo, but the backlash and not a profitable, I'd assume he means fight, didn't make sense, boxing business sense. Munguia versus Canelo on PBC and DAZN so they can gauge the numbers for the Benavidez versus Canelo. I mean, look, this is all I've got to say about this fight is at least we're getting an interesting Canelo fight. I don't think anyone's going to favor Munguia, but Munguia's a lot better than I think people give him credit because he basically went about 7 years without fighting a guy that you cared about outside of Gabe Rosado, and Rosado was a little older at that point. But that was actually a tremendous fight, given that he had knocked out Beck the Bully prior. I mean, this is a fight that I think when it comes around, I think will be better than people think, because Munguia's, like you've said, offensively reckless. And I think that that stylistically makes for an exciting fight with Canelo. Because a guy that's willing to punch with him, what does Canelo do? He hits really hard and he punches. When fights have not been good with Canelo is when guys are not going to stand and trade. To me, this has a chance of being a very exciting, explosive fight. I think the disconnect, like I'm seeing Jesus M is saying, not really interesting fight. Essentially, Munguia has not done anything at 168. I get that. I don't think people are going to favor Munguia, but I think when you look at the two styles, you can see maybe a potentially unhinged fight because neither guy, I think, is going to go, okay, I'm going to outcraft this guy.
I think that Munguia being a little bit offensively reckless, but also being fluid in his, right? We're talking about guys who have fluid offenses. Like, he knows how to put them together. He does things with a certain level of variety. I don't think he's a predictable guy. I think he's in his physical prime. We've been seeing for the last couple of years not bad performances from Canelo, right? But he's just not as much of a freak of nature as he was in 2019, 2020, 2021. And I think the timing with which this fight's being made, I can't hate on the fight, bro. I think it's a good fight. There's a lot of times during Floyd Mayweather's career, I felt that way about fights he was taking. It was undeniable that he was taking a tough challenge, that he was taking probably the third choice of the fans or for me, but that ultimately there was other fights that we wanted to see more. And I think you know who I'm talking about, if it's Benavidez, if it's Morrell. So I think it is a somewhat Mayweatherian fight choice, but I think it's a legit fight and a legit challenge, right? Like, when Floyd fought Oscar, was it the guy we all wanted to see? No. But was it a legit fight? Yeah. I think that's the kind of fight we're getting here.
Jesus M says Canelo was never really a 160 or 68er. I mean,
he's definitely a 160er.
I was going to say, fight Golovkin, you're legit a middleweight. And I mean, he became undisputed at 168, so he fought the world champions at super middleweight. You could say it was a weak division if you wanted to, but he still beat every single champion of that era in that division. So, I mean, I find that factually hard. Like, we love you, Jesus M, but like, the facts say that he fought legitimate, proven guys who spent their careers at those divisions. I'm not sure how else we would define it. Janabek beats Canelo pretty easy. I mean, that I think I was telling someone the other day, I think Janibek's not very long for the middleweight division, given how exciting super middleweight is and given the indecisive nature of Canelo. Like, Janibek,
the indecisive and seemingly immovable nature of the middleweight division, right? There's plenty of interesting guys for him to fight, but we just are not getting those.
And it's like, if let's say Canelo moves or an interim belt comes up, imagine Janibek versus Christian Ambili. Right. That's a very makeable fight. That's a very exciting TV fight. So, I mean, that's a main event level fight, and that fight could happen in Canada. It could happen wherever. I just don't think Janibek's going to be a middleweight long, but to me, I don't have an issue with this fight. Now, I get where people are coming from in a golf reference, because, you know, I like my golf. Maybe it's like trying to say the Players Championship is a major. It really isn't a major, but it's still a really good tournament. And if you want to turn on golf on the weekend, you can watch a lot of the best players play in it, but it's not quite a major. I get that this isn't quite what you want, but I think when the fight starts, people are going to be surprised because they haven't been really paying attention to Munguia. They've kind of made assumptions based on the Dennis Hogan fight. They've been in and out on his career. I think Munguia is going to surprise people. I think this is going to be an action-packed fight, and not quite fully ready to say it, but I think there's a really good chance this could lead to a rematch. Because
I think as long as Munguia doesn't allow it to be at that like arm's distance where they're kind of waiting and it becomes a timing fight, if he can assert some sort of pace and physicality, I think he's got a real shot.
I think also like Munguia is a pretty proud dude, it seems, and he's not an idiot. I think he realizes a lot of people think he's been protected, and he views himself as a real badass. And I think that annoys him. And he's if he beats Canelo or has a great performance with Canelo, he becomes a Mexican superstar. Mm-hmm. And I think that the undertone of this fight is, who is the face of Mexican boxing? This is the young Mexican fighter versus the legend. And for fighters looking to fight for their country and be the face of a sport to a country, I think this is going to be the best Munguia, and he's working with a fantastic coach, with Freddie Roach, an offensively gifted one, a guy who, you know, he's had experience going up against Canelo. So, I mean, the more I talk about it, the more excited I get, but I also understand that I don't get excited by the sheer nature of Jaime Munguia versus Canelo. The saying the names doesn't excite me. Thinking about how it could play out does.
Right, and that's why I said it's not a bad pick. It's just it is the most lucrative famous fighter in the sport, kind of taking all of our third choices, you know?
Jesus M, GGG let Canelo off the hook because Canelo was tired after the round five in the first fight. Our good friend Sev of Combat Sports Media said, good afternoon, gentlemen. Good afternoon to you, Sev. There is a reason Munguia ducked Janibek. Well, I mean, Munguia ducked also Demetrius. He's had a very protected career, right? But I think the thing is, what I think Golden Boy or anybody, and this is me guessing, this is my opinion, they'd say, yeah, we probably built him to a certain point, but now he's ready to go. Like, I think that would be the argument is, don't look at the past. We did it for a reason to put him at this position. And this is going to be the truth chamber. Canelo PBC Heyman is gifting Munguia in a payday because he doesn't have a future. I mean, Jesus M, we love you. It just sounds like Canelo rubs you the wrong way, bub. It sounds like Canelo's on the rubs you the wrong way list, bub. Because, I mean, I get it. There's aspects of Canelo that are very unlikable, especially if you're a working class guy, because he's like extremely rich and he gets to kind of do whatever he wants and he kind of can just hold the sport hostage. And I get how that could be annoying, but he's one of the greats of this era. He's accomplished a lot. He's a for sure Hall of Famer. If he's not the face of boxing, he's definitely one of the four pillars of boxing right now that's keeping the sport alive. And him versus Munguia is a fight that is really relevant. And I think the other thing about this fight is it kind of sets the tone for how he might do with David Benavidez. It kind of gives us a hint at this is, I don't want to say a watered down version of David Benavidez, but Munguia's probably doesn't quite hit as hard.
Right. Because let's say they made this fight in 2020 or 2021. 2021, really, in that when he's fighting Billy Joe Saunders, all those fights. I think Canelo stops him, right? And at that point in time, I would have said that him and Benavidez was a 50-50 fight. At this point, I lean towards David, and I think that this fight has the potential to be very competitive. I also think Canelo could dominate it, but I if it had been made a few years ago, I think it would have been no doubt that Canelo would have dominated.
To me, there's major Canelo slippage since the Bivol performance. And part of that slippage, I think, is he bought into his own hype and believed that he was in, like unstoppable and could go through weight classes and stop anyone and be a power puncher and load up on shots. And I'm not fully convinced that we'll ever see that run of Canelo again. And I kind of believe that he's telling us that by basically being like, you know, I would fight Benavidez when I was on my run, but now I'm being a little bit more careful because I'm getting older. That's what I'm interpreting right now.
Sure. I think that's a fair interpretation.
So Lukey's going to load up on his final cup of coffee. We're going to let Mr. Dakota cook on his favorite fight of the weekend, Joseph Parker versus Big Bang Zhang. It's the Dakota's 2-minute rant while Lukey fills up a cup of coffee. It is making its return this week. Why was Joe Parker so outstanding to you?
Well, listen, he's coming off a win over Deontay Wilder. There wasn't really anybody giving him half a chance to win that fight, and he swept it 12-0, and he made Deontay just look sort of unenthused and past his prime. It's an incredibly impressive performance that he then probably deserved the Joshua fight immediately after, right? The theory was that Wilder and Joshua were going to fight. That's not the fight that got made. And so instead of getting a fight with Joshua as the reward for such a dominant performance, he has to fight Zhilei Zhang, who just is coming off of two dominant knockout wins over the last guy that Parker lost to, Joe Joyce. Obviously, we know the triangle theory in boxing doesn't always work, right? But Joseph Parker was physically overwhelmed by Joe Joyce in the context of when that fight happened. And Zhilei Zhang completely, I think, altered the career of Joe Joyce. So this was a truly 50-50 fight, and on paper, a potentially more dangerous fight. Not more dangerous fight, but high risk, low reward, whereas fighting Joshua sort of is the big fight. And listen, he gets dropped twice. Hard. I think he was buzzed, like legitimately buzzed the first time. I think that Zhilei Zhang has incredible power. And I think regardless of whether he was hurt or he got put down, he stuck to his game plan. He boxed a beautiful fight. He's much more athletic and fast than really anyone at heavyweight outside of maybe Usyk. And I think he was just a step ahead, right? We see every time guys would fight Mayweather, I hate to use him all the time as the standard, but we used to watch guys fight Mayweather and we go, why aren't they letting their hands go? Why aren't they letting their hands go? And there was a reason, right? It's like guys throw feints, guys hand speed. Speed makes you keep your hands in your pocket because you're concerned about what's coming back and whether or not you can even see it coming back. And so I think that's really what made the win so special for Parker. He had to, you know, recover from two different knockdowns against one of the two or three biggest punchers in the division. And ultimately kind of wound up giving him a boxing lesson, even if the cards were tight.
Yeah, I mean, to me, Joe Parker was always the Hall of Very Good. He was first ballot Hall of Very Good. He did everything well, but it just felt like all the greats of the era it was missing one thing. Maybe he was missing Andy Lee. Because it seems like since he's made this shift to Andy Lee, we might just have a Hall of Fame boxer in Joe Parker. I guess technically you could call him a two-time heavyweight world champion now. He seems more enthused than ever. You know, his body language, I think he truly believes he's one of the best of this era. And it kind of reminds me of the resurrection of Tony Bellew late in his career, where Bellew, I had an assumption about where he was from the Donna Stevenson fight. And then later in his career, he just kind of became a different guy. Maybe Carl Froch is another guy like that, where it's like constantly the underdog late in his career, constantly upsetting people. But what's different than like those two guys, they had like a massive chip on their shoulder. Joseph Parker does it a little differently. He's like extremely friendly the whole time. It's like he's not phased by the doubt. He's not fueled by the doubt publicly. He's not ridiculing.
That's genuine confidence though, right? Like that's what real confidence looks like. It doesn't look like walking out with a circus. It doesn't look like walking out with 30 girls with hula hoops, right? It looks like Joseph Parker.
And I think that in the midst of his ups and downs in his career, he found who he was as a prize fighter. And I think that's what the scariest thing is he's got all this experience and he knows who he is as a man. He knows who he is as a fighter. Let's look at some of these comments.
We got a pop in comments.
Why wouldn't we? So, comments on this. Jesus M. More of Zhang didn't do much. To be fair, Zhang is 40 years old as someone.
But I think that is worth noting, right? Like he did have Parker legitimately hurt the first time and there wasn't a lot of follow up. And I think that that was he missed his opportunities when they were there. And I think that Parker capitalized on his lack of engine also.
Okay, let's take it a step further, bro. Let's take it a step further.
Because Zhang's tough, but that's the criticism, right, is the engine.
Let's take it a step further. Is that Zhang or is that Joe Parker also being a crafty veteran, knowing that Zhang is a guy that if you stand in front of him like Anthony Joshua likes guys to do, he's going to hit you really hard and you're out. Like, I think a part of that, too, is he didn't punch because Zhang punches really hard and has to set his feet. And even when Parker was hurt, he knew if I move here, I move there. Zhang has to take 7 steps for my 3 steps because he's loading up so much and he's so heavy on his feet. I mean, I get that he has to blame himself, but I also kind of think like when every shot you throw is a power shot, this can happen. You can throw. But
coming off of the two Joyce wins, I somewhat agree with you, Jesus, because to me, and this is just, I'm watching it. I'm giving Parker all the credit. You've been hearing how I feel about him. But if I'm in Zhang's corner, it's like, I got to see you working a little more, bro. Like, we're at this level. We're one fight away from maybe being like one of the guys. I got to see you want it a little more. And I think that there have been a few performances of late where guys just look unenthused. And this, to me, on some level, was one of them. And I couldn't tell you if it was physical. There just wasn't a whole lot of follow-up that showed a sense of urgency.
Well, and I think that the other thing that comes into my mind is, like, does getting paid a lot of money, is that the victory for some fighters? Because, like, that starts to – because with Wilder, that came into my mind. I guess Joe Parker's 2 wins, can I discredit him as much as possible? Like, did the 2 guys that Joe Parker just had phenomenal performances about, they
– Listen, like, I think if it's not Joe Parker, those guys are still knocking guys out, right? So Joe Parker is the common factor here. But I do think that there we have seen in recent times, Jermell Charlo against Canelo is a perfect example. There's been multiple of these Saudi performances where we've seen them where guys just don't look entirely engaged.
Composed performance from Steve. The Zhang kept Zhang thought he won. Also a comment above, people thought Zhang had won the fight. I think that goes into probably our next conversation with Nick Ball and Ray Vargas. Like, if a guy just gets knocked down, I always feel like there's going to be a subsection of fans. We saw this also in the Kevin Lorena Justice Hooney fight, where if a guy gets knocked down, people immediately forget everything else that happened in the fight. And it's like a street fight and they go, well, he got dropped, so he should have lost. That's like, I feel like there's a subsection of fans that play street fight rules and not the unified rules. A great comment from Lionel Watson that says the three heavyweights who took their profession seriously are the three guys that are at the top, Usyk, AJ, and Joseph Parker. I think there's a lot of truth to that.
And Fury is there because he's extraordinarily talented, but it's not necessarily because his work ethic, I think, equates to those guys.
And I think if Fury had the work ethic, he might be above those guys. But what's keeping him at that level is that he doesn't have a work ethic. And I think what we're now waiting on is Fury going to get old overnight in the Usyk fight? Because we just saw him struggle with an MMA guy that Anthony Joshua ran through rather easily and Fury kind of struggled with. Dakota, when Zhang hurt Parker, he would just stare at him. Man K Crazy said Sean George, the coach of Zhang, he would say he doesn't like pressure. Zhang does nothing. Was Parker hitting the gloves? Zhang's side felt they won. I think people forgot Parker turned pro at 19, only 32.
That's a great point, Steve, because I think if you put it into context, it's like when he was fighting Joshua and Dillian White, he was about the same age as Ryan Garcia and Devin Haney right now, right? So that was at that point in his career. And now he's a guy in his early 30s in his physical prime with a lot of experience. And I think he's really come into his own.
Yeah.
And by the way, if we criticize Wilder or Zhang, like Parker showed up to do his job, bro. He deserves the big fight. That's the bottom line. It doesn't matter if Wilder showed up and didn't want to let his hands go. Joe Parker did the fucking job, so he deserves the fight.
Zhang always gets tired since the start of his career, says Jesus M. Zhang was about 290 in the ring. I saw a lot of comments about that. At 291, does Zhang have a bad camp? Why is he so heavy? Zhang's team was telling him to finish, but didn't follow instructions. I mean, I always feel like when a guy comes in extremely heavy and then has a bad performance, you're always going to wonder, like, did he, like, I wouldn't say he had a bad camp, but my wonder is there an unknown injury that we don't know about? Because typically through my experience, especially with heavyweights, which is very limited, when guys come in heavy, that means that they're hurt. Typically it's like knees, they can't run. So the weight piles on because they're injured and they're big guys and they're still training, but they're just not able to let the weight float off because they have to also kind of keep their body at bay to make it to the fight night.
Right. I mean, I don't think he looked any different than he's ever looked, right? Like, he's just a really big dude. He's always kind of been pushing 300 when he gets in the ring. He's 6'6", 6'7", whatever he is. Like, he's just a big fucking guy, bro.
Yeah, Ray Vargas, Nick Ball. What is it about Ray Vargas that makes people so, like, I feel like there's a lot of guys that box and turn and look like Ichabod Crane in the ring. And there's like even guys complain, right? Ray Vargas at the end of this fight, for people that didn't watch it, Nick Ball knocks him down. He starts doing the complaining to the ref thing. I feel like for a guy who held a belt for a presidential duration, right? He had like a belt for like 4 years. A lot of people just don't care, you know, and maybe that's because Golden Boy Promotions at the time was in a transitionary phase. They were going from the PBC fighters, now PBC fighters leaving Golden Boy, and Golden Boy had to rebuild, and they were on like Facebook Watch and they had some HBO days, but it was a really weird time for Golden Boy. But to me, I was kind of surprised at how little people cared about Ray Vargas and how much people wanted to see Nick Ball win this fight, because it led into a potential Ray Ford unification fight, when to me it was like, okay, this is Nick Ball's first chance against a world-class competitor. And does Ray Vargas is he still able to compete at that level? I would not like to believe that many of our fight fans left since 2017, but it sure feels that way, because a lot of the people commenting on these things were saying this was the first or second time they had seen Ray Vargas, who was a decorated world champion, which might speak to his weight class of super bantamweight. I don't know. What did you think of both Vargas leading in and of this fight?
I've always been a fan of his skill set. I think his height and his style of boxing has always been interesting at the weight classes he fights at, because he just looks like he doesn't belong at those weight classes. It's sort of a lower weight Fundora kind of situation. And he's always been really difficult to hit. And I think, like Combat Sports Media says, I think inactivity is a lot of that, right? Like he's coming off that post HBO era. And when you fight once a year, man, it's tough for people to get attached to you. And you just sort of become that champion on paper that's like holding up fights. And I think that there's some of that sentiment. I mean, I also have to be brutally honest, bro. I just feel like when we have a British fighter with British commentary, it's very difficult for them to contain themselves and call an unbiased fight. It just becomes the British boxing hour. And I don't know if that's football culture or what the root of that is, but they bring nationalism into their fight commentary. And it doesn't matter where the fight is or if they're the only ones doing the commentary, they bring that with them. And I think that it shapes weird narratives. It makes world champions B-sides in fights. And I find it increasingly not fun to watch. And I felt like Nick Ball was the recipient of a lot of that grace yesterday.
I also feel like Ray's at the end of his career, because he had fought guys like Nick Ball, like Oscar Negrete, Azat Hovhannissian, and made those fights.
Ronnie Rios,
and made those decisive victories. This definitely feels like it's closer to the end than the beginning. And like, ACSM left a comment, Ray Vargas is horrible, clumsy, stumbling, dropping hands, just awfully hard to watch. I think this kind of sums up a sentiment to his career, which is, to me, a little unfortunate, given that he fought the guys of his era. His style is his style. It's not necessarily an action-packed style, but it's highly effective. When he beat Mark Magsayo, 2 years ago, that was one of the best wins in that division. And yet inactivity, along with, I think, fans just not really being interested in the way he fights, has kind of gotten him written into a no man's land in the featherweight division, which is pretty much looking for someone to say, I'm the guy. I think it's Luis Alberto Lopez right now, but pretty much every dominant champion has handed off the belt. Lee Wood is no longer there. Alberto Lopez is...
But again, Ray's coming from this previous era of featherweights that was chronically inactive, bro. Leo Santa Cruz, Gary Russell. That's the era he's coming from. And so I think people just are indifferent to his career.
I think they didn't watch his career. I think the big problem was...
They don't remember. You know, they don't remember that he was a dominant champion at 122.
And I think you're right. But I think also some of those fights were on Facebook. Like Golden Boy did those weird Facebook watch fights that I think didn't get the viewership that a lot of people watched. And I think that he fought in a division 122, which typically isn't really watched if your name isn't Nonito Donaire or Nao Inoue. These are guys, these are divisions people don't watch. Jesus M once again, Dakota, who is to blame with rugged tactics, ball charging in, but Vargas was ducking his head to lean in to headbutt. So Vargas is to blame as well. Our guy Sev.
I thought that the first knockdown was not a legit knockdown. It felt like he got pushed and then hit on the way down. The second one was a little bit more of a gray area because I think their feet got tangled up. I think Ball was rushing in because he felt like this is the only way that I can close distance and make Vargas uncomfortable. I'm not going to be able to do it with head movement and slipping the jab. I just have to kind of jump in, and if I can push him to the floor, if I can toss him around, if I can make him feel the physicality, that's my best bet in the fight. And he did that successfully down the stretch, which was very impressive. Because he got completely outboxed for the first six rounds and then just righted the ship. And I think he did it with dirty tactics, but that's also on the referee.
Good points. Israel Madrimayoff, what do you think of him winning a world title? his career has been weird, man. He turned pro against Vladimir Hernandez, stops him in a scheduled 10 rounder. That was his first fight. And you could arguably say up until this point has been a gradual decline in competition. He had those weird two fights with Michelle Soro. Soro would inevitably lose to the opponent. I can't pronounce his name. He would fight on this card.
Karbanov.
And it's an interesting situation because he went from being probably one of the most heavily hyped, exciting, emerging fighters to 6 to 7 years later, people being like, oh, I kind of vaguely remember him. Whatever happened? And him and Bivol in particular feel like COVID-19 really derailed their careers because it felt like there was momentum building. COVID hit and there just wasn't fight dates for him. And he's never really gotten back to that activity since COVID hit. He has a title. Where do you see him in the division?
I think the division with Charlo vacating the belts is in flux. I think Tim Zhu is the obvious choice as sort of the top guy at the moment. The Thurman fight will help to determine that. But I think Madrimov is a victim of the same issues that Ray Vargas or Keith Thurman. Maybe victim is the wrong word, but when you aren't fighting regularly, right, regardless of the reason, the public becomes disengaged unless you're already a superstar who can draw attention fighting once a year. And Madrimov never got to that position in the sport. And so I think it's, even if he's fighting a top 10 guy like Soro, that's not necessarily getting the attention of the fans in the same way. Activity or inactivity can be a killer.
I think it's compelling matchups too. And I think you just said that. It's like, I've always viewed him as a really talented fighter, but he's never had his Ray Ford fight. He's never had his fight against Charles Conwell, Tim Zhu, and for whatever reason. And when you don't have these interesting matchups and you're a heavily favored fighter and then you become inactive, I think enthusiasm starts to go because fans want exciting, interesting matchups. And when those don't happen, all of a sudden you get thrown to the back burner to either guys that are having more exciting performances or guys that are fighting more exciting matchups. And I think he came because he's a physical freak. You saw it with the backflip. He can do crazy gym videos. But I think that the last few years has been a little bit of a wake-up call that just being talented, just being a guy that can do cool stuff in the gym, there is a shelf life for that. So hopefully with this title, he can force some very compelling fights in the near future.
Yeah, and I think this was sort of that the kind of performance you want to have to remind people, right? He fought an unbeaten guy who had 20-something fights, who I think was good, a good, credible fighter, right? This was a legit title eliminator.
Title fight. Didn't he win the belt?
Title. Well, was it an interim belt? Or was
I think it's the straight up, I believe. I can do research. I think he's a straight up champion, WBA champion now.
Well, that's a beautiful thing, and hopefully, you know, he can continue the momentum, which has kind of been the thing that's been lacking in his whole career, is momentum.
And often I feel, let me look at, like, the rankings of this. Often I would like to believe, yeah, that was for the belt. And then if you look who's number three in the division, we might have a great fight on the way. Virgil Ortiz is magically number three in that division. So imagine if we could get Virgil Ortiz versus him later this year.
Love it.
All of a sudden, now we have a great fight.
Love it. That's a great matchup.
That's a great fight. You know, that's a great fight. D Styles Boxing, our friend, said new means no. Didn't save boxing, but he established respect from boxing, was lacking from casuals that thought MMA guys were better than boxers at their own sport. He's responding to our headline. Great comment. Beck Bully doesn't fight as well. That's true. He's struggling with staying active. They blame PBC fighters not fighting, but DAZN fighters like Israel also fight once a year. I think that chronic inactivity has spread across every promoter. I think you can look through each promotion and you can find a fighter who we could argue just doesn't fight enough. I don't think one promoter's to blame. I think that we just don't have enough fight dates for fighters to fight across any promotion.
Or you got a guy like Arnold Barboza who's been like, oh, the next fight's a big one for 7 fights in a row now, you know, and he's just lives
for it. 5 years.
Yeah.
5 years, for half a decade, he's next fight's a big fight. Is there anything else we want to touch on this card?
I think just briefly, like, I talked to Jack and Nibs a little bit about this yesterday, but it's just like, to me, it feels like there is a level of bias with some of the, I'll say Matchroom specifically, but it feels like it's across British and UK boxing right now, where there's just no ability to separate themselves from their nationalist pride towards their fighters. And I think that that's a beautiful thing. But that's for the fans. When you get into commentary, when you get into the people that are really operating the sport, it's like you can see these people openly rooting for people. And even the sports minister from Saudi Arabia, they were openly saying on the air that he called Anthony Joshua and said, I'm rooting for you, and, you know, make the sport look good. These are the people that are operating our sport. These are also supposed to be unbiased entities. And I just think that Matchroom in particular is showing out in the open bias that I just don't think is good for boxing. And while I don't know where Lukey went, maybe he's on another espresso run.
No, I'm here. Lukey's here. He had to go to the bathroom. Lukey had to go to the bathroom because he drank coffee, and then coffee comes right out of you. I mean, look, boxing's in a weird place. We're waiting for the next Floyd. We're waiting for the next Pacquiao, and that person hasn't arrived since. It sort of was Canelo, but then Canelo's also been like, yeah, I'm that guy, and I'm not going to cater to boxing fans. I want to be rich, and I'm going to do the Canelo thing. I think that bias now is just going to be a part of boxing, because the fact that the new model of boxing...
Be careful with that shit, though, bro.
No, what I'm saying is, the bigger problem I have is networks are now going in with promoters. They're not buying content from boxing promoters, and boxing promoters are competing to go to networks. Inherently, when you're doing exclusive deals or semi-exclusive deals with one promoter, there's going to be a level of showmanship. There's going to be a level of selling the product, because now they're all in on one product to build a fighter. That's business. So I get what you're saying about bias in British boxing, but I think it's across the board now, maybe not as apparent in some instances, that each network has certain promoters they work with. And
I think the point that I'm making is actually more so on a smaller scale than that. What I'm saying is, when you have an American commentator, or you have a Mexican commentator, or you have a commentator from almost any other part of the world, I don't feel like they default to rooting for the guy that's from their region. You know what I mean? Like, there is still some, look, Tim Bradley was very biased towards Ray Ford. These things happen, but it doesn't come with the same level of like, he's from the neighborhood, how can I not, you know?
I hear you, but like, we're heading into an area where boxing has never fully been taken serious, right? If we're going to be honest, like, there's a level of circus that boxing operates. It's like why there's a crossover for many people, boxing and pro wrestling, right? Because there's a lot of things in boxing that if a tennis player did it, they would not be able to get away with it. Like, it's almost like a rapper. A rapper can get away with things, but then Taylor Swift can't. It's like, they're a rapper, we don't take them serious. They're like cartoon characters. There's a level of boxer where there's a little bit of a gray line. That being said, it's really feeling like as we're getting away from network television and being viewed on a bigger platform, on bigger stages. We're going more and more niche, which is allowing bias in commentary to happen more regularly, in my opinion, and more freely.
Well, and now we're coming into an era of boxing where a country's sports minister who is overseeing a fight is calling fighters and saying they're rooting for them. That's not an unbiased, that's theater.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a really strange time, and I don't really want to touch on this subject, but it's like the...
I'm not, we don't have to touch on it fully, but we don't, the New York State Athletic Commission doesn't call their favorite fighter before the fight. That's the point I'm making.
And I think that for that, I guess the point is the defense would be I'm a boxing fan, so theory embarrassed boxing. So I guess that would probably be the theory. For me, I like my, and this might sound offensive to some people, I like my sports to be a retreat from the hardships of life. I deal with a lot of sadness. I deal with a lot of harsh realities in life as it is. And the intersection of that into boxing is sometimes fascinating. Like, right? Because like boxers fight for their paycheck. Literally, we fight metaphorically for our paycheck. There's a level of the harder you work, the more you become what you want to become, etc. But when we start to tie in things that I pick and choose what I want to know, like politics, when we start to bring in race relations, it starts to complicate my relationship with this sport, for better or for worse, because I'm tuning into this sport often for what I want from the world, which is strict competition determining who's the best. You know, not all the other things that kind of corrupt the world. It's seeing two athletes, regardless of gender, regardless of race, compete to see who is the best on that given night. That's what motivates me. That's what uplifts me. And there is an element of caution when I watch some of these events where I wonder, are we entering a world in which we can't talk boxing and we have to enter into conversations that I actually, throughout most of my adulthood, have tried to avoid. I read The Economist, but I try to avoid getting Dakota on here and talk about economic theory. I try to avoid sharing my political preferences. I try to avoid these things. Why? Because there are Republicans and Democrats that tune into this podcast and they like Lukey and Dakota and they enjoy our show. My political opinions don't matter. I'm here to give people boxing content. And my deeper concern, and I'm going on a soapbox rant, is I just hope we can stay within a boxing framework and get the good fights we want. And I think the hope I have is maybe boxing has an empowering feature and it can empower maybe conversations in the political landscape that are helpful to people like myself and others. But I do have a fear that our sport at some point might turn into getting away from what I love, which is talking about great and compelling matchups.
Well, and it makes it really hard, right? It's right in our face all the time. There are things about these Saudi events that are sort of right out in the open that are strange and different than any other boxing event we've ever seen. And it puts us in this position where we're either talking about it or we're thinking about what a complicated issue it is. And it's injected itself into the sport. And I think that being right on the heels of what has been an incredibly strange meltdown from Ryan Garcia in the last week.
Let's get into that too, because that actually is
they tie to each other, because when you, in the same week when there's a massive event in Saudi Arabia where one of our biggest stars has a public meltdown, and then one of our biggest stars who's not athletically achieved anything is fighting a 60-year-old man. And those are the highlights of the week, in a sense.
Well, and obvious to me, the positive was the fight in Saudi, because at least a sporting competition is right. coming forward. And honestly, it makes me think what's wrong with it at some point, because it's like everything else I'm seeing. I mean, I don't see anything inherently wrong with Paul versus Mike Tyson, because that's just theater. That's people have a deep relationship with Mike Tyson. People find Jake Paul entertaining. It'll be probably sanctioned, you know, as an exhibition bout, and it'll be a money fight. It'll be a fight for just let's make money. Everybody leads in a Lamborghini. Let's go on. For me, the uncomfortable conversation is Ryan Garcia, because none of the outcomes of what's going on are good. Like, there's no outcome. You could say, okay, he's faking it for attention. That's not good. You could say he's really having a breakdown. That's not good. You could say we're going to take him at face value and someone's kidnapped him at some point. That's not, there's no, I don't see how you could look at this and go, he's doing all right. And to me, honestly, I'm a little concerned leading into this fight. I don't want to say I wish anyone to not fight in a fight, but I have major reservations about him fighting a serious athlete like Devin Haney, who's taking this fight extremely serious. He's not buying into any of this stuff. You're only seeing him in the gym working extremely hard. Given how complicated life seems for Ryan Garcia, it's a little concerning.
It's totally concerning, and I think in any other era in boxing, it would elicit a different kind of reaction than what we're getting at the moment. And like you said, any of the possible scenarios for why this is happening, for why he's behaving as strangely as he is, none of them are good outcomes. And I don't think they are going to lead to a good performance, and he's fighting, you know, one of the five sharpest guys in the game right now. So when you see somebody speaking in such an unhinged way, it's hard to see how they function as a person, let alone fight the best man in their weight class.
It's just, I'm old, Dakota. That's what this makes me feel, because I don't speak social media anymore. Like, we talked about it. You talked to me quite a bit on and off this telecast, and you probably know about 70% of the stuff going on in my life. That's what you told me. And I never once am like, okay, I'm in a public place. Let me go on social media and just share where I'm at. Like, I have severe paranoia about that. If I was having a mental breakdown, which I may or may not have had in the past, I would not go to my phone and try to elicit emotions. So, like, the other issue about this Ryan Garcia thing is it makes me feel old. It makes me feel a little bit like I'm not youthful, because there's a level of I just don't understand the language he speaks. And it feels like a different language where...
Well, let's talk about the language he speaks for a moment, right? Because, and again, it's not on Lukey and Dakota for talking about it. Ryan Garcia put this on the internet and put that in all of our faces intentionally. So that nobody's picking on anybody. The kid talked as if he's been kidnapped, as if he's been forced to watch very disturbing things that I'm not going to repeat. The kid speaks as if crimes have been committed against him. And everyone goes, he's fucking around.
And it's in and on.
It's but insane.
It's also in such an unhinged fashion that I think people are not taking it serious, because nothing he's saying makes any sense. It's coming off like a guy asking you for money on the corner, not saying that's what it is, but it's coming off as serious as I talk as a guy asking me for a dollar and saying he just talked to God. That is the way I'm interpreting it.
Bro, and that's a great point, right? At a certain point, Devin Haney's 25 years old, too, and I don't feel like an alien when he opens his mouth.
I don't feel like an alien when I watch Devin Haney's content. It's like, I'm in the boxing gym. I'm in front of a luxury car from the money I've made from my boxing career. I'm with a famous celebrity that I want his or her fans to see me with. It doesn't feel as – it might not be what I would do, but it feels like what a rich athlete who works hard would want to represent themselves in a social platform. Ryan Garcia's stuff is just flat out bizarre, and it's
newly bizarre, by the way. The 10 months ago, watch an interview of him from the Tank fight. Completely different guy, bro.
Very likable.
Different guy.
Very likable.
Thoughtful, right? Like, not my favorite, but there was really nothing to dislike about the kid. Truly. It was like just a young guy pursuing tough fights. And what's not to like? Win, lose, or draw, the kid's got a set of balls on him. And it's in the last less
literally than- last week after the it started with the LA press conference with Devin Haney, where the dad had a comment that was, we're not going to repeat, but it was at worst, at best ignorant. It was at best ignorant, and at worst, you know, we won't say what it is, but people can interpret how they want to interpret it. Ryan did no media interviews from what I saw, left that press conference. From that press conference, seemingly has had 7 to 10 days of just really strange social media interactions.
And nothing to do with the fight. Everything to do with things that
with him. Let's with keep him. It real. It's a very, it's like, you're not going to find a poor person typically posting this. This is a very, I don't want to say narcissistic because he could be battling mental health, but this is a very famous person issue kind of he's facing. Well,
it's either that or there is something going on in his life that's very dark that we don't know anything about.
It's just sad, bro, because it feels like we're watching the decline of a very promising fighter. And there's not really anything any media member can do, right? Because we don't have access.
It has to come from his family. It has to come
or the team or the people around. And I think given
the people in your life,
given how this fight plays out, it could potentially shape how people look at many of the people around him in the short and long term. That's about as much as I want to talk about that because it just makes me sad. I do want to get back to boxing and actually talk about real fights for a second. There were two niche cards. I'm sure not many people watched, but we do this show more so for these type of fights than those clickbaity moments that we just had that more people probably skim to watch. But Eye of the Tiger ran a really interesting show on ESPN Plus. I was on coverage for Boxing Scene, and it was a great card, to be honest. It was really interesting. We had two first round knockouts. Alessius Iglesias stopped Marcelo Caceres, who had dropped Edgar Berlanga, and DeBago Pacheco had gone 9 rounds with him. He stopped him in 1 round, and he looked like a capital G guy. He's one of these super middleweights who's defected from Cuba, and he holds a win over Morel in the amateurs. Interesting guy to kind of watch because I expected that to be a pack of the lunch fight and settle down and get 10 rounds in. Also on that card, Stephen Bang Bang Butler knocked out Steve Rolls in 1 round, landed a right hand, stopped him on the ropes. Rolls was propped on the ropes. He threw like 3 really hard left hooks, and they thankfully hit Rolls' shoulder. Because if they had to hit him on the chin, it probably would have been like a really sensational and scary type knockout. It was a really strange sequence to the end of that fight. Probably the end of Steve Rolls' career. Steve is 39 years old. He got brutally knocked out in that fight. I'm not sure I really want to see Steve back. And then there was also a guy named John Obario. He's, I believe, a 20-year-old fighter from Colombia, training in Canada. He's a lightweight. Obviously, he wasn't in with the toughest composition. He was in with a guy who basically was trying to go rounds with him, poke and prod him, not loading up. And he found a way to stop him to the body. It seems as though the promotion is very high on this John Obario guy, and the hope is that he can do something exciting probably in the future. The words that Coach Mark Ramsey was they want to challenge him, but they don't want to move him too quick, which kind of tells you where they kind of see him. I don't think they see him as contending, but they also want to kind of keep him engaged. Last night, I also watched the All-Star boxing card. There was actually a couple of notable fights that I thought stood out. So let me just tell you about them, because most people probably didn't watch these. This guy, Jairo Noriega, won the main event. He's a light flyweight, 108 pounds. He's from Spain. He's kind of got the Sandor Martin style. He's able to box. He's able to bang. Good hand speed. He's going to be in a world title fight. He's good enough to be at that level. He won a 12-rounder last night against a guy with a good record, a puncher. I believe that it was this guy's hometown as well. He was undefeated but went in there. Interesting fighter who I wouldn't be mad if you saw him in with the likes of Ken Shiro, in with La Bamba Gonzalez, in with the other champion, Nantashinga. He's an interesting guy who I thought had world-class attributes in the fight. And then there was a guy who will totally get slept on because he's 105 pounds, but he was co-signed by Roman Chocolatito Gonzalez. His name is Michael Carmona, the assassin, and he was a fantastic fighter, and he stopped Thomas Villar in 2 rounds. Brutal puncher. He was listed as an orthodox fighter, came out southpaw. I think if you want to see a sneaky good fight, check out Edwin Soto versus Gennaro Sanchez. It was kind of a back and forth fight. Cano, not known for power, stopped Sanchez. These are kind of more purist fights. That fight card on All-Star Boxing on ESPN Plus reminded me of my fond memories of coming home, sitting down on Saturday nights, watching tape delayed solo boxeo cards from Mexico. And for me, I really enjoyed that experience as a boxing fan, muting the volume, watching some fights against guys who were probably going to come to America as a B-side. I remember I saw Saul Roman in a great fight on solo boxeo, and they get sparked out by Curtis Stevens, which kind of told me the level of the fights. But with all the nonsense we just talked about, those were two fight cards I thought were really compelling. So I wanted to give those fighters some shine because I think oftentimes people overlook that type of fight card.
Bro, and shout out to Stephen Butler for scoring that kind of win over Steve Rolls, who in the last few years has given some of the best young middleweights the hardest rounds of their career. And overall, when Butler has stepped up in competition, he's been stopped. That's a pretty massive win for him that I think kind of puts him in a different kind of conversation where it's like, yeah, I would like to see him in Troy Isley. I would like to see him test, you know, the
Ian Green.
Yeah. Or even guys like, you know, Joe Sean and Javier Martinez, some of these young middleweights, like he becomes a very viable matchup for them in my mind.
Yeah, very much so. And I think it's his second fight with Iceman John Scully as this coach. So there might be a correlation between a coach change and the performances, but I was pretty impressed. Like, look, with Bang Bang Butler, you know what you're getting. You're getting a guy who's going to overcommit to some shots. He's very hot-headed to a certain extent, but when he lands, he can really punch. And there's always a place in the sport for a guy like that. You know, self-described to me, the Arturo Gatti of middleweight. That's the way he wants to view himself. Never mad at a guy like that. We got two questions from the chat. Then we're going to do a brief breakdown, and then we're going to be gone. Andre Novetsky, the chat wants to know if you had any thoughts on him. He opened the AJ card. Dakota, do you have any thoughts on him?
I thought he was pretty impressive. That was actually, I missed some of the early fights, but I caught the beginning of the card, so I did actually see that fight. Again, he's young, right? It's early, but I think that there's definitely something there.
Yeah, I mean, interesting fight. And then also, Manke Crazy wants your thoughts on Zach Parker versus Tyler. I can't pronounce his last name. I think it's Zouge. It's a good British domestic fight. Do you have any thoughts on that yet?
Well, I'm very sorry, my friend. I don't know who Tyler Zouge is, but I do think Zach Parker is a great fighter. I'm not sure that I've seen him since the John Ryder fight, but I think just on a talent level, he's a guy that could get in the mix at 168 without a doubt.
Kind of rushed a little bit. I think they saw a guy that punched hard, and he was probably in the developmental phase, and they kind of stepped him up to Ryder prematurely. And
it's like, you know, you'd be more talented and not be quite prepared for someone's physicality.
I think that's literally, you can't teach experience. That's literally the definition of you can't teach experience. John just had a little bit more experience and just kind of could feel things in there. And I think Zach felt a type of pressure in that fight that he had never felt before. And it just was very uncomfortable. And I think Ryder also is the perfect storm of when guys are uncomfortable, he is very happy to make you even more uncomfortable. He made a whole career out of, oh, you're uncomfortable, let me do more of that. Let's go over real quickly, William Zepeda versus Maxi Hughes. There's title implications to this fight. I'm not exactly sure. I could pull up a press release, but there's title implications with this fight. Maxi Hughes coming off that should have probably been win over Kambosos. Maybe it was a draw in some people's minds, but he had a very solid performance. He actually lost it on paper, but I think a lot of people felt he won the fight. And William Zepeda has looked like one of the best lightweights for a couple of years now. So what are your thoughts on this?
It's a great matchup. I think it's a proper matchup. I think it's a good, fair matchup. And I think that Maxi Hughes does deserve that kind of fight. And how unfortunate for him that, pretty much anyone I talked to thought he beat Kambosos, and time kind of heals all wounds, right? Because now Kambosos finds himself in a fight for a title against Lomachenko in a few months. And that opportunity was not afforded to Maxi Hughes. I've been waiting. I think he deserves the fight. And I think we've been waiting to see Zepeda in like something closer or something that resembles a 50-50 fight. And I think this is kind of the first one.
I mean, to be fair, Zepeda fought Jojo Diaz. And at the time, I really was high on Jojo, and he outworked him. And I feel like with Jojo's instability outside of the ring, that win has gotten lessened. I think Zepeda has behaved the part because he beat Hector Tananahara, who was a solid prospect with Golden Boy. Zepeda really has done everything asked of him. It's just been a weird time where one guy had all the belts, and Zepeda is a high risk, low reward fighter who throws a ton of punches. And I just don't think there's a lot of guys lining up to fight a guy like William Zepeda. Do you think the movement and we're the Keep It Real podcast, some of the dirty roughhouse tactics at times that Maxi Hughes implements, do you think any of that could factor in and maybe slow down Zepeda?
I think that there's a lot of things about Maxi Hughes that Zepeda's probably never been in front of. You know, there's a level of movement and angles and thoughtfulness in how Hughes fights that I don't think Zepeda's been in with that style really just yet. But I think it's an odd thing, and I can't validate like the truth in this, but wasn't there a time where he was offered a fight with Shakur Stevenson and turned it down? Is that accurate?
I believe so, but that's like totally like internet stuff. So like, I don't, because like we always need context.
A lot on ESPN where I remember the commentator saying, oh, William Zepeda was offered this fight and didn't take it.
I mean, to be fair, that kind of makes sense, right? Because Shakur is probably the man in that division. And I don't think people are lining up to fight Shakur. And that's why I think Shakur's kind of burnout on boxing is he at times might not be the most entertaining guy, but he's the guy that for a decade plus, everyone's like, man, Shakur is going to be really good. And now it's his time to be really good. And he can't really get the fights he wants because everyone's like, who's the more famous guy? Because Edwin De Los Santos leaves the Shakur Stevenson fight and we're not seeing him getting a fight with another lightweight, and that sadly in the boxing world right now, it's just as much about how much money can I make after this fight with another fighter as it is fighting the best opponents at that moment. But I can't speak on that because business is done behind closed doors, and you have to know more to know what it was. Maxi Hughes was offered Dalton Smith and was insulted. Smith is fighting Chon Zepeda.
Yeah.
You think Chon Zepeda still has it? Sadly, I don't. think Chon Zepeda has it. I don't know. What do you?
I also think Hitchens really has it. So it's tough for me to say if he just got outclassed by a potentially generational talent. You know, Jose Zepeda have been fighting top guys for a long time. So you never know if this is the kind of fight where that experience gap, right? Like we said, how you react to physicality, this could be the type of fight where something like that plays in. Because I think just on talent, where they are in their careers, Dalton Smith would be a massive favorite in that fight, but there's intangibles to having experience.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a trajectory fight where Chon Zepeda seems like he's trending in the wrong direction here. He's had a couple of since the Ivan Baranchuk fight, he's really had a lot of grueling fights. It seems like it's taken a lot out of him. And Dalton Smith, though, I'm not sure he's as good as people are saying. I think he's a talented fighter. I'm not sure he's going to be a generational fighter. These typically are the fights that, like, a guy at the end of his career, very promising fighter, these are the fights that the younger, more distinguished fighter typically beats the aging veteran, especially when they go overseas. That's just my thought, early thoughts on that fight, which we will break down next week. Like, literally, if you wait 1 week, we will give you more, but that's my early thoughts. Williams Payne and Maxie Hughes, what's the keys to victory for both?
I mean, Hughes has just got to keep Zepeda off balance, and Zepeda's got to really make Hughes feel his physicality and his power. He can't allow the fight to be fought at Hughes's pace.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting. I just think that it's hard to stop the work rate of William Zepeda if you don't have power. I just think that this is a guy that's just going to be fine coming forward. And the only thing I see offsetting it is power. I don't even think great movement's going to do it, because Zepeda is willing to punch.
Yeah, and we know that Hughes is not a huge puncher, but we know he's very accurate. And it's just a matter of, can he be accurate enough to frustrate Zepeda and keep him off him?
But Zepeda did have that weird COVID fight where he kind of dropped and got slipped and everyone was kind of low on him. Does he have another one of those in him? Like, he's kind of had these remarkable fights over and over where we've kind of forgotten about that performance. But, like, there was a time where people's enthusiasm dimmed on Zepeda because of that one performance.
Yeah, I don't think his ascent has been as fast as people thought. The big one was Hector Tanahara, right? That was the first
one. And that was a sensational fight because that was viewed as a 50-50 fight, and he got a corner stoppage. And then the next one was JoJo. It's like, okay, this is a JoJo. And I think that was really perceived as a 50-50 fight. The problem is his 50-50 fights, when you take a 50-50 fight, you kind of are hoping the guy you beat goes on to have a distinguished career after you beat him. His problem has been the guys he's beat have either not fought that much, Hector Tanahara, right, or JoJo went on a losing skid. So he's been in some 50-50 fights. The problem has been after those fights, the guys haven't been as distinguished.
The wins are not aging well. Even though the quality of the wins in time, I think, shouldn't be in question. It's just that the fighters, like you said, following those fights have had a difficult run.
And I think there's a context to that that's always left out, that sometimes fighters like Zepeda take a little bit out of a fighter's career, and we never talk about that. We just talk about the fact that they never won again, but we never talk about fighting a guy that throws 1,500 punches in a fight might change the way you fight because you just have some things. Zepeda was a heavy favorite, Man K Crazy says. So to me, I guess I looked at that fight as like a closer fight. The odds makers saw Zepeda as the favorite, the Tanana. So, I mean, this is an interesting bout, but I think to me, Zepeda has the edge. But, like, let's say this becomes a close fight, all of a sudden, I think there's more interest in... Look, I think he needs to either have a close fight or a dominant fight. He can't have a middle-of-the-road performance because he either needs to get fan enthusiasm behind him, or he needs to struggle to the point where it seems like every fighter wants to call him out. The worst thing he can do in this fight is a performance that merits neither.
Right. Tough style matchup for him.
just two notes on this undercard. We have Floyd Kid Austin Schofield in the co-feature. He's taking on a fighter that I'm not too familiar with. I'm almost starting to wonder if Kid Austin is now going to jump up and fight Zepeda. He's looking like a superstar. They were teasing a fight with JoJo Diaz. JoJo just lost. He's really close to the top of the bill on this card. And just looking at this landscape, what's your expectations for Kid Austin and how far away is he from like a William Zepeda fight?
I think it's also going to be a matter of are those guys willing to fight him, right? Unfortunately, I think particularly at lightweight at the moment with Shakur, it's like if you're a really good technical guy who might make guys look dumb, even if you're the top guy, not everybody's going to be dying to fight you. And I think that Floyd is going to run into some of those issues. And hopefully him and Shakur can solve that problem for each other.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I'm a big fan of Floyd Schofield, Kid Austin, because he's exciting. His father talks a good game. He's like a very humble. It's kind of like the Danny Garcia relationship where you got a dad that seems like a loving dad who's over eager to brag about his son. And then the kid can really fight. He's giving you those performances that you want from a young fighter. He had one 10 round decision, or I think one or two 10 round decisions where, you know, people go, oh, he's going rounds. He got exposed. I think people are eager to say he got exposed. Kid Austin has to beat another undisputed prospect. Well, I think the problem with Kid Austin's having is it's hard for him to get these type of fights because he hits really hard. And I think that that's part of what he's struggling with.
Yeah, and lightweight is at this point a division that's in flux. I would say in a similar way to middleweight, where it's like a lot of the big names have moved up to 140. There's
it's a changing era, Dakota. Featherweight's in flux, lightweight's in flux, welterweight's in flux, middleweight's in flux. Honestly, light heavyweight's in flux. There's a lot of divisions that are changing right now.
The classical money divisions.
So, I mean, he's both lucky and unfortunate in the sense that he's going to be one of the big names when the division changes to the young guys. But I think that a lot of people are also like, let's wait until this is a main event 12-round fight because the kid punches really hard and he's kind of unproven later in fights against high-level competition as a professional right now.
Right.
One other fight I wanted to bring up, Marlon Esparza is having a rematch on this undercard. She's defending her titles. To me, this should set the stage. The winner of this fight should fight Gabriela Fandora, who I think is probably one of the more interesting figures in women's boxing, both based on her style and based on the fact that her brother might be a world champion by the end of the month. That's really the context for this fight. I'm not really looking at it as a sporting affair. It's more than how does this play into a potential Fandora fight down the line?
Yeah, I love me some Gabriela Fandora, and I think she's already at a point after the Cruz fight, we're ready to see her against the top of the division. Esparza hasn't been that active in the last few years either, so I'm interested to see kind of where she's at.
Yeah, it's been a truly strange career for her, if we're going to be honest, and we are honest. She was kind of one of the pioneers of women's Olympic boxing, if not the pioneer. And her dent in women's boxing professionally hasn't been what I thought. Like, I thought she was going to be kind of one
activity, man. That plays so much into it. You know, Ray Vargas was 36-0, undefeated, longtime champion. But if you fight every 16 months, it's tough for the fans to. I'm not saying that's how long she's been off. I'm just saying.
I'm going to look up her activity right now because now you got me curious about her activity.
Well, it's been one. It's got to. If I had to, I'm just guessing. I would say it's like three fights in the last 2 years kind of vibe.
Okay. So we're pulling it up. One loss to Sanice Estrada. That loss was 2019. So she beat Sulem Urbina. Okay, so she had three fights in 2021. She had two fights in 2022, and she had one fight last year.
Right, so three in 2 years. I'd say it's tough for people to keep you in the front of their mind if they don't see you.
And I think the other thing too is we're in a new era of women's boxing where there's kind of like new faces emerging, and she's transitioning from being like the exciting prospect to exciting new champion to fending off the young people.
Like the old guard.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, that's a weird role for anyone, but I think women's boxing, that's a very new role in the modern world of like women's boxing being relevant on TV cards. And I think she might be one of the first figures we're literally witnessing transition into. Where does her career go? Can she fend off this? Because she really hasn't lost outright. Like, she believes she beat Sanice Estrada. I favored Sanice in that fight, but she truly believes, if you ask her, she thinks she beat Sanice. I don't think she's ever left a fight thinking she lost. And yet enthusiasm around her career is dimmed to a degree.
I think for whatever the reasons are, if you have one fight in a year, the enthusiasm about you is going to go down. Like, I think that even applies to somebody like Terrence Crawford, who off the back of such a legendary, epic, and historic win, it doesn't feel like any of the conversations we're having are about Terrence Crawford because he's just not active. And I think that's limited how attached fans get to him.
Just to give a little bit more context, because I actually did research now, this is a literal rematch of their July fight. Going into that fight, Gabriela Alanz from Argentina was unbeaten. It was a majority decision. I, for the life of me, don't remember this fight at all, which is terrible. One judge had it 95-95. One judge had it 99-91. One judge had it 97-93. So it's the classic box rec fight where you'd have to sit and watch the fight because you have no clue, yeah, looking at the scorecards how the fight played out. But to me, the way I'm going to look at this fight, completely unprepared, and I'm sorry to both fighters for being this unprepared, but it happens. This is a trajectory fight for both. So this is, and for me, I'm really looking at Esparza, who was the Olympian, was the heavily promoted fighter. How enthused is she as a pro boxer at this point to rematch a fighter who potentially gave her issues, to merit a rematch, to return, what is it, 11 months later? Is that
That's
right?
That's a good context from Maggie sure. Crazy, is that eight. The fans scored it as a draw on BoxRec.
So it was a close fight. So
we got one of those 9-1 pre-filled joints.
I mean, boxing, like, I feel like the fans watch great fights and sometimes the judges miss them. So this is a fight. This is the winner of this fight should be in with Gabriela Fandora. And if the winner doesn't fight Fandora, who signed a Golden Boy, that should raise questions about what's going on in this division.
Remind me what weight class we're talking about here, because I know that Sanisa moved down.
112.
That's amazing that Gabriela Fandora can make that weight.
Yeah, she's a problem, bro. So that is, and then I guess two little quick housekeeping notes just to let you guys know. If you're in the Big Bad Bay Area, Gabriel Flores Jr. will be returning next weekend at the Adventist Health Arena in Stockton, California. I knew how to spell it. I didn't know how to say it. Good card. Fernando Vargas Jr. taking on Dakota's boy, Brad Solomon. Love a good veteran jumping in there with a prospect. That's a good fight. We got some local talent on the undercard. Come out. You'll enjoy it. Jesse James Guerrero, big ticket seller, will be on there, part of the Robert Guerrero lineage. And then an hour and a half from there on West Side Promotions, put together by Patrick Reagan, you got Manuel Jaimez in a fight. You got Peter, I can't pronounce his last name, taking on Vaughn Alexander. You've got Tommy Hyde in a fight. You've got Vic Pasillas in a fight. So you basically, in Northern California, you got two cards to pick between. They're happening on the same night. It's St. Patrick's Day weekend. Please stay sober. And potentially Dakota might be going to see Callum Walsh in New York, who's one of the more interesting figures in boxing, in the sense that I think he has more UFC fans than boxing fans. And that's an interesting phenomenon.
It was really funny watching a UFC fight pass and watching MMA guys commentate a boxing match and go, what a great strike.
I mean, I like the 360 promotions cards a lot. To me, because of the pacing. So it's like they just run out each and every fight. And if the card is 90 minutes, they're fine with it. And for like the card we had yesterday, that was like a 9-hour event, it's such a welcome change to possibly have a 2.5-hour fight card.
That's something we did, but this episode's already been long as shit, but we didn't even talk about 10 hours of boxing being insane.
Yeah, the pre-taped interviews. I'm like, let's give you an interview.
Listen, a lot of fights, I love that. There was no less than 3 hours of fat they could have trimmed off that event.
It was strange, but so there's a lot going on. I mean, I can't do this, bro. What are we doing here, bro? What are we doing here? I don't know what we're doing, but look, there's tons of great cards. If you're staying at home and you want to watch a great card, Golden Boy's putting on a great card. New York City, St. Pat's Day, Callum Walsh is an exciting fighter. There's going to be good Irish fighters on the card. Bay Area, you got two different cards to choose from. Both are going to have guys that I think will fight for world title fights. Gabe Jr. is fighting an undefeated fighter, which is exciting. He's 19-0-2. Good record, fought on big cards, so that's a good main event. It's an exciting time to be alive if you like just boxing. And that's what I was kind of thinking about last night when I'm watching All-Star Boxing. I'm like, I need to watch more All-Star Boxing ESPN Plus cards because I really love when it's just boxing. I really love when it's just boxing. Like, it's so much fun for me to watch a great fight. And I think that like lately the context of boxing has burnt me out.
I'm right there with you, bro.
Dakota, where can people support you, follow you, and catch up with your latest stuff?
You can follow me at the Slip and Weep Podcast on YouTube, on Instagram, and stay tuned with me in the next couple of weeks. I'm going to do a little bit of a relaunch of the Slip and Weep Podcast. I never stopped doing it. I just haven't been able to do it as regularly, and I'm just making some changes to the show, working a couple of kinks out, and I'm going to try to have it be a weekly show again, whether I can get a guest or not. So stay tuned. In the next couple of weeks, I will be launching that.